For many American Negroes, the sit-in movement has become a rallying point in the struggle for full equality. And yet there is as well a significantly large number of American Negroes, the Muslims, who have objected strenuously to the sit-ins. In view of this, Mr. Malcolm, I would like to ask you, what is it precisely that the Muslims object to about the sit-in movement?
Yes, Mr. Donald, and first I would like to say that I'm speaking not for myself, but as a follower and helper and representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, who is the spiritual head of the fastest growing group, religious group, of black people here in the Western Hemisphere. And when we give our views, we don't give them as a civic group, we don't give them as a political group, but we give them primarily as a religious group. And any solution that we set forth, we absolutely feel that it's a religious solution rather than a political solution. One of the reasons that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, in teaching us here in America, is giving us a solution that differs drastically from the sit-in movement. He's trying to make us men. Now, the very fact that you find students all over the world today are standing up for their rights and fighting for their rights. But here in America, the so-called Negro students have allowed themselves to be maneuvered under a tag of sit-in. The word sit itself is not an honorable tag. Anybody can sit. An old woman can sit. A coward can sit. A baby can sit. Anything can sit. But it takes a man to stand. And when they attach this sit-in term or title to this movement, it stigmatizes it. It stigmatizes it, in my opinion.
Is this the passivity of it that you object to?
It describes it. The name describes its nature. It's a passive thing. And also, we feel that to try and sit down in another man's restaurant to drink a cup of coffee is insane. If I were in the South and a Southerner didn't want me to eat in his restaurant, and I forced my way in and then let him go back in his kitchen and prepare some coffee for me to drink, I'd consider myself insane to drink it. We don't think that that's the solution. We feel that rather than to force our way into someone else's restaurant or public place that they have established, that we should get our own. Once we have our own, we're respected for the fact that we can create our own. And that's equality right there. Thirdly, we feel that the sit-in movement actually represents a new Negro in the sense that it represents dissatisfaction. It shows that the new generation here in America of black students have lost the fear of the white man that our parents had. 20 years ago, the average so-called Negro, if he was dissatisfied with something, the degree of dissatisfaction that he would show would be tempered or controlled by his concern as to what the white man's attitude would be if he showed that he didn't like it. And the sit-in movement, the good part of the sit-in movement, in my opinion, represents the fact that there is a new generation of so-called Negroes who are dissatisfied. And the fact that they will go into these places shows that they differ from their parents in that they have lost fear of that obstacle that their parents feared. Now, I think that the white man realized when the sit-in movement first started that it was a dangerous thing. And in my opinion, the way he has captured it and controls it right to this day, he put the same leaders that formerly had kept the Negroes walking along a patient, passive road were jockeyed into a position where now they are the advisors to these students. Being accepted by the students as advisors, the student sit-in movement, in my opinion, has lost its militancy to the degree that it has accepted advice of these preachers and politicians who usually are for their own personal benefit rather than for the masses of black people on the whole. And I would like to say in conclusion on that point that if a man is going to have his tooth pulled, the pain that he receives from the extraction will make him manifest a violent reaction. pain automatically makes a person resist or put up some form of action to defend himself from that which is causing him pain. But to keep a man, in order for the dentist to be able to handle the patient, he puts Novocaine in the patient's jaw. And though he's still extracting the tooth, this Novocaine makes the patient think that nothing is being done to him. And I think that the student sit-in movement shows that the black people here in America finally became so overburdened with pain that they were about to display some violent reaction to all of these injustices. And to keep this down, I think that the powers that be maneuvered these Negro preachers and other politicians into a position to advise these students, and it was just like injecting Novocaine into them, and their militancy today, again I say, is displayed according to the degree of advice they accept from the older leaders.
Would you agree that their goal is a worthwhile one?
If their goal is integration, it's not a worthwhile one. But if their goal is freedom, justice, and equality, then that's a worthwhile goal. If integration is going to give the black people in America complete freedom, complete justice, and complete equality, then it's a worthwhile goal. But if this word that they've invented, integration, and as I mentioned, the Novocaine that is put into the patient's jaw, in this sense, it would be integration. Just the holding this integration bottle, dangling it in front of the Negroes in America today, has actually disabled them, or it has nullified their ability to stand up and fight like a man for something that is theirs by right, rather than to just sit around and beg and wait for the white man to make up his mind that they're worthy to have this type thing. I think that this is, in my opinion, why we disagree with the sit-in movement. If they are willing to wait for another 100 years for the white man to change his mind to accept them as a human being, then they're wrong. But if they're willing to lay down their life tonight or in the morning in order that we can have what is ours by right tonight or in the morning, then it's a good movement. But as long as they're willing to wait for the white man to make up his mind that they are qualified to be respected as human beings, then I'm afraid that all of their waiting and their planning is for naught. As Thurgood Marshall said on New Year's Eve, the Supreme Court brought about the desegregation decision, I think, 6 or 7 years ago, and there is only 6% desegregation in America right now. We don't call black students going to University of Georgia integration, nor do we call four children, black children going to school in New Orleans integration, nor do we call a handful of black students going to school in Little Rock integration. If every black man in the state of Arkansas can't go to any school he wants, that's not integration. And if every black child in the state of Louisiana cannot go to any school that they are qualified for in the morning, then that's not integration. And likewise with Georgia and any other state in America. It's no integration with us until the entire thing is laid on the table, not 100 years from now, but in the morning. And at the rate that the NAACP, CORE, and the Urban League is willing to accept the change of attitude in the white man's mind, we who are Muslims feel we'll be sitting around here in America for another 1,000 years, not waiting for civil rights or something like that, but even waiting to be granted the rights of a human being.
Mr. McCullings, do you feel that your movement has been emasculated the way that Mr. Malcolm described it?
Quite on the contrary, Mr. Donnell. The first thing I'd like to point out is perhaps many people have been quite uninformed as to the start of the movement and the reasons for the movement. Many people seem to get the idea that this movement started as a result of somebody coming in and organizing and saying, this is a way that we can achieve full integration. So why don't you students get together and do thus and thus? The situation is quite on the contrary. The movement started in Greensboro, North Carolina, with a young man from Washington, D.C., who was a student at A&T College, who decided one day while downtown that he'd like to have a cup of coffee. And he decided that he'd go into a drugstore that had been, as far as he could remember, and probably as far as any of his parents or grandparents could remember, was strictly taboo as far as the lunch counter was concerned. This particular young man decided that he would go in and sit down and order a cup of coffee, and he did. He was refused. Then and there, he decided that something could and should be done about this particular thing. And one of the best ways to do this, he decided, was through a nonviolent, peaceful means. The weapons of violence are quite obvious. I think that any intelligent individual can realize this, that you can fight a weapon of violence. The weapons of nonviolence are not so obvious, and it becomes very difficult to cope with them. The reasons for requesting a cup of coffee were not because the individual desired a cup of coffee so much. For I'm sure that if he had gone back to the dormitory or gone back to the campus, he could have very easily got a cup of coffee without any trouble at all. After the movement began, it became quite obvious that the argument, the sit-in movement, the demonstrations were not for cups of coffee, but were for all the other facets of life that individuals have to come in contact with daily. I think that this too has been visualized in a wrong sense. 9 times out of 10, if the students in the southern schools were served coffee, anytime they wanted to be served at these lunch counters, they would never bother about buying it. But I think that they visualized that there had to be a starting point. And this was just as good a starting point as any. With a demand for a cup of coffee at a lunch counter that was strictly taboo, from an individual who had always remained on top and subjected his fellow man, the Negro, to all sorts of discriminatory ideas and concepts. This immediately became a challenge to explore all the other facets of life, employment, education, and everything else that you want to name. This then is the reason for the sit-in, not to secure a cup of coffee, but to explore and secure all the equal opportunities available to all Americans and our democratic way of life.
Mr. Baldwin, do you foresee the possibility of the kind of equality that Mr. McCummings talks about?
Well, before I answer that, I have the feeling that a great many words have been floating around this table, which need to be redefined. And that, by the way, is the problem, I think, which is facing this entire country. Now, I don't agree with Mr. X about the sit-in movement, and I do know something about the war, the incipient war between the students and some of the leaders. I know the gap, the enormous gap between the NAACP and the children in the South. I don't agree that the sit-in, I don't agree that it is necessarily passive. I think it demands a tremendous amount of power, both in one's personal life and in terms of political or polemical activity. Sometimes to sit down and do nothing, or seem to do nothing. But finally, I think what we have to argue about here is what I don't quite know any longer, what this word integration is supposed to mean. Now, if I thought the student movement were involved with some desire to be served a cup of coffee by a white man because he was a white man, or to be accepted by people, I personally, I have to put it this way now, there are a great many people whom I'm not prepared to accept as my equal. Some of them are white and some of them are black. And from my point of view, integration in terms of being raised to the level of an illiterate Mississippi cracker is not integration at all. It seems to me the hope of this country and the role the Negro can play in it is to raise these people to a level they have not yet achieved. I think we're arguing about the question here, when the sit-in movement started, or when a great many things started in the Western world, it was not, I think it had a great deal less to do with equality than it had to do with power. And I do think we have to decide what we want, Now, what has happened in the world in relation to black people is not the white people have suddenly changed or become more conscious of a black man's humanity. It is what has happened is very simple. It is the white power has been broken, and this means, among other things, that it is no longer possible for an Englishman to describe an African and make the African believe it. It is no longer possible for a white man in this country to tell a Negro who he is and make the Negro believe this. The controlling image is absolutely gone. Now, it seems to me the responsibility which faces us then, the question which faces us, which faces me in any case, is since there is a distinction between power and equality, there is a distinction between power and freedom, and I know that in terms, for example, of Africa, that an African nation cannot expect to be respected unless it is free. I know that unless it has its political destiny in its own hands, which is what we mean by power, there is no hope that the English will deal with an African nation as a subjugated nation as long as it is in fact subjugated. Now, this is not quite the same situation that we face here in America as American Negroes. It is not, in my mind yet anyway, conceivable. I can see that I might very well, for one reason or another, leave this country tomorrow and never come back. But I will not cease to be an American Negro for this reason. And the history of our history in this country is something that I think we have to face, especially since we're demanding that white people face it. And whether I like it or not, whether you like it or not, this issue about integration is a false issue, because we have been integrated here ever since we got here. I am no longer a pure African. There are no pure Africans in this country. The history which has produced us is something which, in any case, we're going to have to deal with one of these days. Now, I think it is a mistake. I think it is a mistake to pretend this history did not happen. What we're arguing about, I think, one of the things, in any case, I think I would be arguing about, is the effect of this on the Negro world and the great divisions in it, so that it does in fact range from people who imagine they are white, you know, who never talk to Negroes, to people who imagine that if they can make a buck, they will somehow beat the system, to homeless and demoralized black boys and girls who have don't know where to go. The issue, it seems to me, the reason that the sit-in movement is important, the reason this whole ferment is of such importance, is not that I want anybody's cup of coffee, or even to go, particularly to anybody's school. It is because the country cannot afford to have, as it has at this moment, millions of black boys and girls in various ghettos all over the country, either perishing literally, or perishing, I must say, finally, with the kind of demoralization and bitterness and hatred, which can, after all, blow this country wide apart. The importance, in my mind, of the Muslim movement, in conclusion, is that it is the first time, I think, in the history of this country that a Negro audience, a Negro laborer, a Negro schoolboy has heard his own condition described without anybody trying to flinch from it. It is very different from hearing a speech by Roy Wilkins in which, you know, one is told in one way or another that tomorrow will be better. And I think this has a tremendous effect. This is the reason the Muslim speaker has so much power over his audience. It comes out of a failure in the Republic. This country has lied about the Negro situation for 100 years. And now what has happened is that the lies are no longer viable, can no longer be accepted even when they can be told. And the country has waited so long that it does not know how to handle this and has created a moral vacuum. There's a moral vacuum in the Negro ghettos in the same way there's a moral vacuum in New Orleans, which is filled with desperate people. Now, I don't think that we can afford this. We can go on about this a little longer. Something else I wanted to say. It seems to me, and now I speak for myself, that one of the great, my quarrel with the official Negro leadership, and my quarrel with those such Negroes as imagine they are integrated or imagine they somehow escaped the Negro condition, is that they are not willing to do what I think is absolutely essential. One has got to re-examine the basis, the standards of this country, which not only afflict black people, they afflict the entire country. No one in this country, as far as I can see, really knows any longer what it means to be an American. He does not know what he means by freedom. He does not know what he means by equality. We live in the most abysmal ignorance of not only the condition of 20 million Negroes in our midst, but of the whole nature of the life being lived in the rest of the world. And I think that the American white man, the Republic, is beginning to pay fall. His treatment of the Negro in terms of what he does not know about the rest of the world. You cannot live, it seems to me, you cannot live 30 years, let's say, with something in your closet which you know is there and pretend it is not there without something terrible happening to you. By and by, what I cannot say, if I know that any one of you, you know, has murdered your brother, your mother, and the corpse is in this room and under the table, and I know it, and you know it, and you know I know it, and we cannot talk about it. It takes no time at all before we cannot talk about anything, before absolute silence descends. And that kind of silence is descended on this country. I think that this country has become almost inconceivably radical overnight. It has really got to do something that has not done before, and this involves the humanity of everybody in it. And the key to this is in the Negro. If one can face that, one can face anything, but that has not been faced. And I think this is the reason for the confusion and the ferment and the great, great danger. Again, let me say this, and I will stop. I don't think... I'm not religious. And therefore, since I'm not religious, all theologies, for me, are suspect. All theologies have a certain use, but... I never, for example, believed in the image, the myth of the virgin birth, and I never quite understood why it was necessary to propagate such a peculiar notion. Therefore, you know, as theologies go, it seems to me the Muslim theology is just as good as any. One cannot quarrel with it there. I can't, anyway. But I don't think... I personally reject that theology as I reject all others. And I don't think... that we need it. Now, this is a gamble, and this is a very reckless thing to say. And perhaps, you know, perhaps it's very mystical. I know the kind of world I would like to see. I would like to think of myself as not needing to be supported by a myth. I would like to think of myself as being able to face whatever it is I have to face as me. Dealing with what I have and what there is, without having my identity dependent on something which finally has to be believed, which cannot be tested. This is why one is converted to a religion, you know. I think that there's something very dangerous in it. What I would like to see, and maybe we will never live to see it, is a world in which these things are not necessary. In which it will not matter, which I will not need to invent, in effect, a heritage and a history, but I can deal with the one I have, and will not need, in order to deal with the rest of the world, will not need to feel superior to them, but simply be a part of them. And it seems to me this may happen. Well, I'd love to see a world in which there are no blacks and there are no whites, where it does not matter. Because as long as it does matter, as long as it does matter, and it doesn't matter who is wearing the shoe, the confusion will be great and the bloodshed will be great.
Mr. Malcolm, do you see yourself as an expression of this kind of radicalism that Mr. Baldwin is talking about?
Well, I, as a black man, and proud of being a black man, I can't conceive of myself as having any desire whatsoever to lose my identity. I wouldn't want to live in a world where none of my kind existed. I do think that the Negro, American so-called Negro, is the only person on earth who would be willing to lose his identity in a what you might call a new product. I heard one fellow say one day that there eventually intermarriage and intermixing would take place on such a vast scale that it would produce a chocolate-colored race, and Martin Luther King was in a televised discussion with a white newspaper man. I saw it on the television a couple months ago, and this white newspaper man put this to him. He pointed out that he's proud of his white race. He's proud of what he is. He's proud of his racial characteristics to the extent where he has no desire to lose it by mixing with any other race. And the thing that he said he couldn't understand was why the so-called Negroes don't have the same racial pride that whites have in trying to retain their characteristics. And Martin Luther King never answered him, although he should have answered him. I think that it is disastrous for the black people in America to reach the point where their racial pride disappears, and they don't care whether their blood is mixed up with someone else's. I think that also one of the things that brings this about, as the Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us, the very fact that you have to refer to the black man in America as a Negro shows you that right there something is wrong. An African doesn't accept this term Negro, and you find they teach us in the educational system of this country that Negro is a Spanish word that's supposed to mean black. Yet when you find the black people who live in Spanish-speaking countries of South and Central America, they don't accept the word Negro to identify themselves. No one allows himself to be classified under the word Negro but the black man here in America who is a descendant of the slaves. And very seldom is it ever applied to anybody but the black man in here in America who is the descendant of the slaves. When you ask a man his identity, he should use a word that connects him with a culture. If you ask him his nationality, it should connect him with a nation. Like if I ask a man his nationality and he says German, that connects him with Germany. Or if he says, even if he says German-American, it still connects him with having originated. His family, his history has originated in Germany. If he says he's French-American, it connects him with France. But when you ask the black man in America and he tells you Negro, he doesn't put any other country in front. He puts American Negro, or he'll just say Negro. This doesn't identify him. And usually when you find a man who calls himself a Negro, he can't tell you what language that he spoke before he came to this country. It's of no consequence, no interest. He believes that prior to coming here, he was a savage in the jungle, and therefore he had no language. And this justifies his lack of knowledge concerning that mother tongue today. Usually, if he calls himself a Negro, he has a name like Murphy. Murphy is an Irish name. He's a black man with an Irish name, which Mr. Muhammad teaches us he got during slavery. If a Chinese were to come into a restaurant and tell you that his name was Murphy or O'Toole or MacDougall, people would laugh at him. They know that he has no business with a name like that. And if a yellow man has no business wearing a white man's name, then the question is, how does a black man come about a white man's name? And the history, as Mr. Baldwin pointed out, of the white man here in America and the black man here in America points up the fact that the Negro, or the man here who calls himself a Negro, is just an ex-slave. If he is an ex-slave, I'd rather say he's still a slave. But he's wearing his slave master's name, the name that was given to him during slavery. He's speaking the language of the man who made him a slave because he has no knowledge of his own tongue. He only knows the history, his own history, as taught to him by his former slave master, who purposely hid from him his own history to make him think that he was an inferior being before being brought here. And Mr. Muhammad teaches us that until the black man here in America is connected or reestablished or given some knowledge of his existence prior to coming here to America, his own appraisal of himself will be so low that he'll actually think that the white man is doing him a favor to let him be here in America, no matter what his status is. And he also, and this is one of the reasons today why he fights so hard, some of them, to sit down next to the white man. They actually think that the white man is the personification of perfection. And whenever they're allowed to go live in his neighborhood or sit in his restaurant or mingle or socialize with him, that they have attained, that they have made progress. But when they go back and study the history of their own people, and the accomplishments of their own people, the civilizations and cultures, black civilizations and black cultures that existed in Africa at a time when the whites in Europe were living a cave-like existence, then immediately their appraisal of themselves begins to go higher. And they don't think that to beg somebody to mingle with them in this country is any kind of progress whatsoever. And I would like to say one more thing, too, on that nonviolent thing, that the black man in America is the only one who is encouraged to be nonviolent, or the black man in Africa, or the black man in Asia. Never do you find white people encouraging other whites to be nonviolent. Whites idolize fighters. They idolize the Hungarian freedom fighters who came to this country and right now can work on jobs that the sit-in students can't get, can live in neighborhoods that the sit-in students can't live in, and can go into public places that the student sit-ins can't go, because they are fighters. Everyone loves a fighter. They respect a fighter. And but at the same time that they admire these fighters, they encourage the so-called Negro in America to get his desires fulfilled with a sit-in stroke or a passive approach or a love-your-enemy approach or pray for those who despitefully use you. This is insane. And we feel as Muslims, until we see white people practicing this nonviolence, until we see white people take Pearl Harbor. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, the American white man didn't say, pray for the Japanese and let them now bomb Manhattan or Staten Island. No, they said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. When we study the entire history of the white man, he believes in violently defending himself. But when we study the history of the American so-called Negro, who is trying to get his rights whenever he has an organization that is integrated, which means it has white advisors who are in top position, usually he's being encouraged to be nonviolent, to be passive, and to be loving, and to be patient. But we have never seen the white man himself display these same characteristics or methods when he's trying to get his own goals accomplished. And right down here in Cuba is another example. The entire government praise the violence of the people who were trying to overthrow Castro. Now, this is, they're condoning violence, they're encouraging violence, and they're praising violence. But when it comes to the black man in Mississippi, now they say they're trying to bring freedom to Cuba, and they'll do it violently or any other explosive way that's necessary to get an enemy away from their house. But here you've got black people in Mississippi who are treated worse than anybody in Cuba. You've got black people in Georgia that are treated worse than anybody in Hungary. And you've got black people in this country who are treated worse than anybody in Africa and Asia ever dreamt of being treated. And instead of someone encouraging them to stand up like a man instead of a boy and do something to bring about a change in these conditions tonight, they're encouraged instead to be nonviolent, to be passive, to love their enemy and pray for those who despitefully use them. And another good example was right up there in Boston, here in New York, when Rockwell, this Nazi, was going to make a speech down here in the village, and another one in Boston. The Jews stoned him. They stoned him violently. I've never read in any paper where the Jews were practicing violence. They stoned Rockwell in the village, and they stoned him in Boston, and not one newspaper has yet said that the Jews were being violent because they stoned Rockwell, because he was looked upon as an enemy of the Jew, and he hadn't even done anything other than mouthed a poisonous doctrine. And today, they tell Negroes that they should forget everything that the white man has done. As Senator Humphrey said at the African Freedom show there at Hunter College last week, he told the Negro they were booing him. They wouldn't even let him speak. They didn't want to hear what he had to say. So finally he told the crowd to forget, don't dwell on the incidents of the past, because they only create bad feelings. Let's look at the future and go forward. In other words, he was telling them, forget what we've done. We know we have treated you. We've committed crimes against you, but forget this. Let's look ahead. Things will be better. Now, Negroes are taught this. Whenever an injustice has been done to a Negro, collectively or individually, he's told to forget that and forgive, because we're trying to make things better now. But and if anybody comes along like Mr. Muhammad and begins to point out uncompromisingly in blunt terms that don't need interpretation or diplomatic language that can be misinterpreted, and he begins to point out these atrocities and crimes that have been committed against black people here in America today, the white man can never deny the fact that he's guilty, but he'll always say, well, forget the past and let's look forward. But the only people who are told to forget the injustices that have been done to them are the black people. But when it comes to whites, right today, you can turn on any radio, turn on any television, read any newspaper, and the Jews have magnified to the world the crimes that were committed against them 20 years ago or so by Eichmann, And they keep you sitting on the edge of your seat wanting to strangle Eichmann and strangle the Germans. This is it's almost like a Hate Germany campaign. But yet the Jews are never accused of teaching hate because they remind the world of the crimes that were committed against them. But when the black man here in America begins to stand up and speak about the crimes that are committed against him throughout America every day, no let up, just different forms, immediately a black man who dwells on that is considered a racist, considered an extremist, or considered someone who is advocating a doctrine that'll bring about violence and bring about a deterioration in the so-called good relations that are supposed to be developing between black and white in this country. So we just can't go along with any of that. And I think that until the black man here in America is willing to do and ready to do the same thing that Patrick Henry did to make this country what it was for white people, Patrick Henry, and there's another point. Here the white man takes as his hero George Washington. He was a warrior. He was a general. He fought a war. They take as their hero Patrick Henry. These are men who fight, who fought, who were willing to lay down their life and die for the freedom that they knew was theirs by birth. But these are the heroes of whites. But when a black man in America begins to talk the same kind of talk that Patrick Henry has gone down in history as being famous for, this man is considered as something that shouldn't be allowed to talk. And I think that it's time, as Mr. Baldwin said, in a sense of tossing aside the hypocrisy and looking at the facts the way they are, and not trying to be diplomatic or not trying to be nice, but deal with that problem the way it is. And when you realize that the black man here in America today is just not ready to continue waiting for the white man to make up his mind that he should be a human, that he's a human being too, otherwise you're going to have trouble, then the problem can be solved. If you have a slave and you got your foot on his neck, as long as that, and someone comes along and tells that slave that he's a man too, well, naturally, the slave is not going to wait for you to take your foot from his head. If he's a man and you're a man, he can remove your foot from his head. But the thing is this, as long as that slave is willing for the master to change his attitude toward him, there's no violence. But when that master is not ready to cease immediately, if that slave really considers himself a man, he's going to stop the master from treating him wrong. He's not going to wait for the master to stop. He will stop him himself. And I think that this is the thing that the white people of America should realize, that Mr. Muhammad's teaching, and it's spreading, so you have to deal with it. Mr. Muhammad's teaching doesn't teach the black man to wait for the white man to change his mind. Mr. Muhammad's teaching is changing the black man's appraisal of himself, and as soon as the black man undergoes a reappraisal of himself and realizes that he's a man too, he says to himself, why should he wait for the Supreme Court to give him what a white man has when he's born? Why should he wait for the Congress or the Senate or the President to tell him that he should have this, when if he's a man the same as that man is a man, he doesn't need any President, he doesn't need any Congress, he doesn't need any Supreme Court, he doesn't need anybody but himself to bring about that which is his if he is a man. And I think that this is the type of man that you're dealing with here in America today. They don't like to face it, but this is the type of man. That doesn't mean he's a advocator of violence. He wants freedom. He wants justice. He wants equality. He doesn't want it 100 years from now. If the white man has it right now, the black man should. If the white man has it today, the black man should have it today. And if the white man got it by being willing to die for it, then the black man will not get it until he too is also willing to die for it. And this, I say, I think is the basic difference between the Muslims and the other groups across the country.
Well, Mr. McCummings, could you subscribe to this kind of discipline? Do you feel that you have denied a heritage, as suggested by Mr. Malcolm?
I could not, definitely not subscribe to this sort of thinking. I think that most of the students who...
I think the important thing is the fact that Mr. Malcolm has established, in his own minds at least, that the American Negro has a heritage, and that a person such as you are denying it. Would that be true in your eyes?
Definitely not. I think that while I'm not denying my heritage, I think that one of the things that we're missing the entire boat on is the fact that the issue is not whether we should rise up and fight the white man with violence here in this country. Mr. Malcolm has mentioned the struggle of races, the struggle of mankind throughout the world. The white man, George Washington, who was a warrior, the individuals who said, give me liberty or give me death. And this all is good. This is very good. But it does not suffice for the particular problem that we are faced with. We're not faced with a problem that confront two countries. We're faced with a problem that's internal. I just happen to have an investment in this country. So do all the other Negroes who have lived here, who were born here, and will probably be here for the rest of their lives. Whenever an individual is called upon to defend the country and the country's concept, whether it's practiced or not, we're expected to do so. And we do so willingly. I think that we would be defeating our purpose. I think that the Negro would completely defeat his purpose if he allowed himself to develop such a hatred attitude that he would begin to fight internally with the people in the country. I think that one of the most important things is that if we are going to survive as a nation, if we're going to elevate ourselves and remain on the status that we are considered leaders of the rest of the world, then we're going to have to do it with all the people in the country. I think that while I agree that segregation, discrimination is wrong, while I agree that man cannot limit others until he first limit himself, I think that the means by which the students have undertaken to pit themselves against these laws of segregation, for truly in the South, there has been established a pattern of segregation. And to remove any pattern in the South, or any pattern in any part of the country, in my estimation, does not show cowardness. It does not show a lack of manliness. In my estimation, it shows more calm, cool, calculated intelligence than trying to meet these obstacles with violence, which is, in my estimation, would assuredly meet with defeat. We have another thing to consider. We have approximately 20 million Negroes in the United States. Our net national product is approximately $20 million. We're $20 billion, which means that we control a very small portion of the nation's wealth. And I can't conceive of using such a small group of people and such a small amount of money, since our basic society is based on a capitalistic form of government, a form of government that has to use money for its own good. I can't conceive of how anyone would say that we should go out and use violence when I think that this would defeat our purpose.
Mr. Baldwin, you've talked about a projected time when both the pride and the prejudice of race might be eliminated. In view of what Mr. Malcolm has said, do you feel that you could deny this kind of heritage that he speaks of, and only look forward to that projected time?
No. Let me try to make myself clear. I think in the first place there's some disagreement between Mr. Malcolm X and myself as to what this heritage is. And I want to go back to that in a minute. Something else at the moment bothers me. That I think there's not much clarity in this question of violence. From my point of view, from where I sit, whether or not, no matter what Mr. McCummings wants, or no matter what Mr. X wants, no matter what I want, I believe, for example, that one of these days, maybe tomorrow, Birmingham, Alabama will probably blow up. And if Birmingham blows up, it will not just stretch to Atlanta, it will stretch to Boston. There's a kind of fuse, there's a kind of there's an undercurrent, there's something which unites all the Negroes in this country, so that what happens in Birmingham can blow up Harlem. It has happened before. And unless we are extremely swift and miraculously swift, it will happen again. I take it as given. I think it is coming in any case. What exercises my mind is what happens then. In the first place, this country, in its position in the world now, is extremely precarious position in the world now. The situation of the Negro here is different from that of the Jews in Germany, let us say, 20 or 30 years ago. In that, if Birmingham should blow up, if they should really erupt in America this week, real racial violence, it would have repercussions all over the world. I'm afraid we have to face this fact, that when the Jews are being slaughtered in Germany in the very beginning, no one seemed to care. Millions of Jews crossed the world, and boatloads of them, and no country would let them in. But the American Negro has something working for him in this context, or the country has something working against it, which I don't think he can afford. I don't think that if I use Birmingham because it's the worst city I've ever seen, and absolutely indefensible that it should exist in this country, the reactions in Johannesburg, South Africa, and all over the African continent, and in Latin America, because we've always treated the Latin Americans, whether we admit this or not, we've always treated them as though they were not white. We've never considered them as being white people, which is one of the reasons we are having so much trouble with them. And, you know, I must say that this is one of the things I meant when I said the price that the white man has paid for his willful blindness may prove to be more than, the bill is coming in. But I want to get back to this question of identity, because it seems to me this is really where all the questions are. Mr. Malcolm X disagrees with the word Negro, and I can see his point. I confess that it doesn't at the moment much interest me, but that may be my fault. What I am concerned about, though, is the actual history of Negroes in this country. I think one has got to face the fact that it has been one of the ugliest histories in the history of the West. But if one can face this fact, there's another fact which I think one has got to face, which is that it's also one of the most remarkable histories that we know of. And I don't think I can be confused any longer with, I'm not talking now about all the good things that white people did, for the poor darkies and all that jazz. I'm talking about the effect of this experience on the people who underwent it, the masters and the slaves, what it did to them. I would be a very different person if I were not the descendant of a slave. And I might be something, I might be something absolutely incredibly marvelous, but this is a myth, this is romance. In fact, I am the descendant of a slave. This is one of the things I have to deal with because it is true. And I don't think that it has to be a badge of shame. Negroes are not the only slaves. We are not the only descendants of slaves. I think that the confusion here is whether or not... I can't eliminate one half of my ancestors. My grandmother was raped, let us say. This is a fact I have to face. This means that I'm no longer a pure African, and that my relationship to white people is not that of a Congolese to Belgium, and cannot be, no matter how hard I try to make it that. My relationship to white people is dictated by my mother's relationship to them, my father's, by the fact that my grandmother nursed children who grew up to lynch her children, that my father's fathers were always under the heel of some benevolent white man, and a whole myth of this experience has come into being in the country, which is at its highest seen in Faulkner and at its lowest seen in Margaret Mitchell. Now, I don't think that we can be liberated from this history until we are willing to deal with it. And this means that I have to deal with it as well as any white man in the country has to deal with it. Now, there's really too much and too little to say. What is the issue here? Malcolm X wants us to act like men, and it seems to me, one of the things that I object to here, I don't think that the fact that white people have done what they have done, Patrick Henry is not one of my heroes. I'm sorry. Most American heroes have never been in my Hall of Fame. I don't see any reason for me, at this late date, to begin modeling myself on an image which I've always found, frankly, to be mediocre and not a standard to which I myself could repair. I don't think that black men now should be, because white men have committed these crimes, that black men should do the same thing. I think that there is something absolutely insidious, even if I cannot make this absolutely clear, there's something, to my mind, always terribly insidious in the whole question of race. The white man's racial characteristics, of which the white man claims to be so proud, have reduced him in this country to incredible levels. The New Orleans mothers, who are so proud of their racial characteristics, are blaspheming these characteristics and have lost whatever was honorable in them because of the means they use to defend them. There is nobody in the world, I think, sadder than a white man in the deep South who only has his skin and his blue eyes and his yellow hair and nothing else. I don't think that I want to go through the world, and I will not encourage my nephew to begin to go through the world only armed with the color of his skin. The only thing that really arms anybody when the chips are down is how closely, how thoroughly he can relate to himself and deal with the world, yes, as a man, you know. But I don't think, I think when I talk about standards, I say they all got to be revised. This is one of the standards that have to be revised. I don't think that a warrior is necessarily a man. And in fact, it has been proven that football players and all these people in teams and in armies are not men. It is very difficult to be a man. And what it involves for me, anyway, is an ability to look at the world, to look at whatever it is, and to say what it is, and to deal with it, to face it, even if it does mean laying down your life, because in a way it always does mean that. But I don't want, this is probably the only reason I'm here this afternoon, what I would not like to see, I would not like to see this thousand-year nightmare begin all over again with a shoe on the other foot. In a way, this is personal, but I had to understand, for my own survival, that the things that had been done to me when I was a child, and the things that had been done to my ancestors, I was now responsible for all these things. It was too bad that my father beat me, you know, and too bad, you know, and absolutely unforgivable, unforgettable, that so many, that the history has been so awful, but it is now, when you become a man, your responsibility to deal with it. I cannot undo it by repeating it. I cannot undo it by, I cannot hate you or your child because of what has been done to me. What has been done to me is now my responsibility, and it's up to me to deal with it and to become whatever I can become out of it, because you don't escape it. You don't escape it. It seems to me that we have here in America, the Negro in this country is the only hope this country has. If anyone in the country has any sense of what freedom is, Negroes do. I don't believe, I really don't at the bottom of my heart believe that the country does any longer. I don't think that the people who are sitting now in Washington, the people who are responsible for our conduct in the world, really believe in the things they say they believe. If they did, they would not be so panic-stricken. And they would not give our enemies, that is the nation's enemies, the capital they give them. The panic caused what we call the Cold War. And the cult in this country of ignorance has made it impossible, for example, very nearly impossible, for a respectable anti-communist to say a word. I know what a communist is. I would know one if one bit me. I am convinced that no one in the John Birch Society knows or cares. Now, the safety of this country will not be achieved by dropping leaflets over Africa, and I have seen some of these leaflets, informing the Africans of the crimes of the Kremlin. The safety of this country can only be achieved in one way, and it is a great question. Do we believe it or do we not? And the only way the country can prove it is to answer this question. Answer it for themselves, not for me, because I know. Am I a man or not? And if the answer is no, it is not the Negro who loses. It is the country that loses. There's one thing that can be said, I think, for almost every Negro in the country, which is that it is impossible to disappoint him anymore. Any Negro who has survived to the age of 20 knows what to expect. Now, what I would like to undercut, I would like literally, really to undercut it, is a necessity which is created, as I say, by the moral failure of the country, for Negroes to band together, not as men but as Negroes, and in opposition to the rest of the society. It seems to me, as Malcolm X has said somewhere, the United States does everything else it wants to do, that are we so convinced that Cuba must be free, that we're willing to send to back an invasion to bring freedom to the Cubans, then it seems to me that we can certainly do something about Birmingham and Mississippi. I do not believe, and I don't think any Negro believes, that we are helpless here. I do believe, with Thurgood Marshall, that the school boards have not been honest, the governments have not been honest, they have not intended to see integration come about, and have done everything they could to prevent it. Now, if one could turn the tide, if one could really elicit from Washington a clear statement and arrive at clear action, if someone would tell the governor of Alabama and the governor of Mississippi, if someone would throw him in jail for un-American activities, then the future of this country would become much brighter than it is right now. When you have a man like Eastland throwing people who have challenged the House Un-American Committee, Un-American Activities Committee, in jail, whereas a man like Welch and an entity like Goldwater have this incredible influence, all which is increasing all the time, it means that the country is acting out what it really does believe. If we really believed what we said we believed, we would be doing something we are not doing. Now this gap, this failure on the part of the American Republic is creating the most savage and most dangerous opportunities for people all over the world. There is no reason for anyone in Cuba or anywhere in Latin America to believe that we know what we mean by freedom or have any intention of honoring that word. No reason for anyone in Africa to believe it. And they don't believe it no matter what our rhetoric says. They judge us by performance. Now, it is perfectly conceivable to me, this may sound very far-fetched, that what the white people are doing on this continent, because this is a continent, including Canada, America, and all the rest of Latin America, is simply isolating themselves out of a world which is no longer white and where power is no longer in white hands. I'm concerned, really, about what is going to happen tomorrow when I will not any longer have a white man to blame. It seems to me that my responsibility, at least as a writer, is to begin to prepare for this day, because this day is coming. It will come peacefully, or it will come with blood. And this has nothing to do with Malcolm X's position or Mr. McCumming's position or mine or yours. It is absolutely on the road. Nothing can stop it. All we can do is prepare for it. And people who do not know how to prepare for it always perish. The French Empire, the English Empire, have all perished for this reason.
Well, we just have a few minutes left, but I must say I think implicit in Mr. Baldwin's remarks are a challenge to you, Mr. Malcolm. Are you ready, in other words, to lead a legion on a 1,000-year reign of terror?
No, I think that they misunderstand when they think that as Muslims we are advocators of violence. But as he said, those who aren't prepared will perish. And the Honorable Elijah Muhammad actually is preparing us for what is coming. And it's not coming because I'm a Muslim or someone else is a Christian or something of that sort. It's coming because as you sow, so shall you reap. And it is the deeds that America has sown, as Mr. Baldwin put more beautifully, I think, in the New York Times on March the 12th in the magazine section, in analyzing the attitude of the students and the attitude of the Muslims. In essence, he said that the students have faith on their side and the Muslims have facts on their side. And I'm more inclined to rely on those facts. And facts are that we've never been violent toward anyone, but if ever we are attacked as a Muslim, we absolutely do not believe in turning the other cheek. And as Mr. McCummings pointed out, he says that we shouldn't act toward whites as we act toward another country, but we are two countries. The white man and the black man in America are two nations, the difference being that the 20 million black people comprise a nation within another nation. And the white man treats us like a subjected nation. We're colonized, just as Britain colonized Kenya and colonized the Tanganyika and France colonized Algeria. The white man here in America has colonized 20 million black people. But he colonized them mentally so that today they don't realize that they were colonized. And back before Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, you had two kinds of Negroes. You had a house Negro and a field Negro. And the house Negro, who lived in his master's house, never wanted to leave because he lived a little better life than the field Negro. But the field Negro, if he ever saw the master's house on fire, he would pray that the house burned down. Whenever his master was in trouble, that would make the field Negro happy because he knew that man up there that had enslaved him was his enemy, not his friend. But the house Negro, when the house caught on fire, and the master would say, well, we're in trouble. The house Negro would say, yes, we're in trouble. Our house is on fire. He always identified himself with his master, in all of his master's wants, desires, and hardships. but that field Negro never did. And you have the same thing today in America. The masses of black people don't identify themselves as quickly with the trouble that the white man is in the same sense that the white man identifies the trouble. When you the black, when America says today, we're in trouble, nothing but a fool black man would stand up and say, yes, we're in trouble. Because the only advances that the black man in America has made in the past 20 years has been when America is in trouble. As long as America is in trouble, the black man in America makes a few advances, not because the white man's attitude is changing, but he's being pressured into bringing about these changes. And I do think, as Mr. McCummings also pointed out, he says that the black people here only control $20 billion. $20 billion is more than Canada controls. $20 billion is more power, purchasing power, than Canada does. And as a, if you base being a nation on your economic power, the black people in America would be a nation in their own right on that score, because economically, they're more powerful. They control more wealth than Canada, but yet they don't get any good out of it because they haven't been taught to try and do something for themselves.
Mr. McCummings, we have 1 minute. Do you have something to add in this perspective?
I keep insisting that by dropping the problem that faces our nation and the laps of the American people, by participating, by demonstrating through nonviolent means, through calm, cool, calculated intelligence, I think that this stereotype will eventually disappear, and all Americans will be looked upon as citizens and not as Negroes, whites, or Indians, and what have you. I think that this is the only way that we can achieve it if we're going to survive as a nation.
Thank you, Laverne McCummings, Malcolm X, and James Baldwin.